I'm Frank Vaughn. It's July 16th, 2026. All is well here. Things are proceeding exactly as I indicated they were going to. I've created a moment to just try and communicate because I feel I've never wanted to communicate more with my audience and had less time to do so. Largely because my wife remains gone and it's just me and the kids, and I am thoroughly enjoying the intensive time. I mean, my son was just reading me a book, and I'm so proud of the accomplishment that my wife has pulled off of making a literate human being, and she's working on making the second one literate. That is just an amazing thing to witness unfold. And now he's got the basics, so he's moving forward on his own. He's picking up books, and he's doing it himself, sounding things out and figuring it out. It's a wonderful thing to watch. But we've been having a good time, because even though I work at home, I don't see them as much as I'd like to. My wife covers for me a lot, and I'm really, not that I didn't appreciate her before, but I really appreciate her now because it's hard to scratch out the extra time that I would like to be able to sit here and chat because the world has been moving, even though I have not been here communicating. And one of the ways it's moving is, of course, the Americans are going hard in Iran again, and the Iranians are going hard back, and everybody's shooting missiles at each other, and it's a great big fiasco. The Americans are saying the Strait of Hormuz must be open. And the way that they're going to get it open is by reestablishing a blockade. And then they were going to charge a 20% fee. And now they're just going to go with some trade and investment agreements. I mean, they're making it up as they go. And I don't know how anybody can't see it. And I need to remind people that the Strait of Hormuz was wide open, perfectly wide open before the war began, with no fees charged to anybody. There were some services, but no fees. We're trying to restore, as a basis of negotiation, the pre-war situation, which we can't go back to. And I still encounter, even though it's getting few and far between, people have either already been awake for a long time or they're figuring it out now, but you still encounter people saying stupid things, and they're stupid. Like, the Iranians were not willing to give up their enriched uranium, even though the day they were bombed, that's exactly what they said. We will give it all up, we will hand it all over, and we will allow, for the first time, we will allow American-appointed inspectors onto our soil to verify that we're doing so. That was according to the Omani mediator, who the Americans agreed to appoint. And they were bombed under a flag of truce. No matter, it doesn't matter if you like the Iranians. I mean, these are people who, during the Iran-Iraq war, took 10-year-old boys, put a key around their neck on a chain, and put bandanas on their head that said, "This is my key to paradise." That's how fundamentalist the belief system is. And they beat Iraq. And unfortunately, Donald Trump doesn't seem to know his history. He said, back in the 1980s, they couldn't even beat Iraq. They did. They persevered. They survived against chemical weapons, I might add. But this isn't the 1980s anymore. Drone technology and ballistic missile technology has changed the name of the game. And now they seem to be fighting over who's going to control the strait. Well, the Iranians will control the strait. The Americans cannot force the situation. Take it to the bank. They can make a demonstration, which is what I think they're building towards. They're bombing Keshem Island. They're bombing the various islands, Bandar Abbas. They keep talking about taking Karg Island. It's not going to be Karg Island. It's going to be one of the other islands. I think they're going to do a demonstration. They're going to go in. They're going to land a bunch of helicopters. They're going to kill a bunch of Iranians, and then they're going to load up, and they're going to fly back out. They're going to demonstrate a raid, and then they're going to announce to the public that they have demonstrated their superiority and hope that that somehow smooths all the problems over. Wars are very easy to start. They're very hard to get out of. And this war is now, what are we, 140 days in, I think? I think my last video was day 133. I think we're about 140 now, give or take a day. It was supposed to be over in 2 days, 1 to 2 days. Then it was 2 to 4 days, and then it was a week, and then it was a couple weeks. Remember, we made a lot of jokes about 2 weeks to flatten the Iran, and we're still here. And this idea that this bombing campaign, which is far more limited than the opening 40 days, with reason, because the Americans are running low on munitions. There's a lot of people out there who think that the United States is immune to the rules of logistics, even though the U.S. military, and indeed the United States, is just one great big logistical company. People don't seem to understand the limitations. This is a region that is 10,000 kilometers away, and many of the people who live there are highly hostile to the United States for all kinds of different reasons. This is a very difficult thing to do. It's also summertime. It's very hot. There's no way in any concept of reality that the Americans can do anything useful to disrupt the Iranian regime. They had a chance. Back in January, they had a chance that they might have been able to foment a revolution, but they sat back and they let the Iranians kill off the protesters who were fomented by the intelligence agencies. The people who could have overthrown the government were repressed in that. And now the Iranian people are completely united, just like they were united to fight Iraq with those 10-year-old boys. You're not going to beat that mentality. We're talking about a fundamentalism that is best left alone in that region, on top of Persian nationalism, which is just one way of saying this is a historic, millennia-old civilization that has been experiencing a couple hundred years of bumpy roads, that is reasserting itself with a modern army. Trump claims it doesn't exist, and yet there it is, blowing up his bases. We've had a number of medevac flights. We're not getting word on American casualties or how many assets have been destroyed. All of this information is very covered up. We do have video that shows Iranian missiles hitting Jordanian facilities. We know Iranian missiles are raining down in Bahrain and Kuwait, destroying the missile batteries that are being used to fire into Iran. Like, I mean, this is an act of war, with hits being taken on all sides. And I would argue the Iranians are doing a better job, because the Americans are very good at bombing empty buildings. Their target list is exhausted. If the first 40 days of the war didn't change the trajectory of the Iranian government, this current phase will not, because the depth of American logistical preparedness, the amount of munitions that they have, is thin, and they're running out. Now, if this is an attempt to do one big hurrah before unilaterally announcing the exit, maybe it is. I don't believe that. I think the Americans are gearing up to do a demonstration, and I think it's going to be a colossal failure, just like this entire war has been. But that being said, I think it's going a bit harder than I anticipated a week ago. That's for sure. We'd be doing tit-for-tat stuff. I think we're moving up the escalation chain again. And it's an escalation of stupid. No good can come of this. But I also want to talk about Carney, because that's been on my mind a lot. There's a few different things, actually, that I think are very important that have happened. First off, this idea. The mainstream media is keen to tell everyone that we're looking at getting out of the F-35 deal, and we're looking to the Europeans, conveying this impression that Canada is becoming more Eurocentric and much more skeptical of the United States and our alliance with the United States. And I think nothing could be further from the truth. I think it's all optics. I think there's an element of Carney playing all sides of the fence. He plays China, he plays Europe, he plays the United States. He's positioning himself somewhere in the middle, which is actually sort of consistent with his idea of the middle powers banding together to challenge the reigning hegemons, which are the Chinese, the United States, and maybe even India. Let's pause there just for a sec, actually, because we need to talk about Modi making statements over the last week that the Indian government very much recognizes emigration. So its nationals emigrating to other nations like Canada as a tool of foreign policy, i.e. domination. Using people in other nations to influence those nations towards India's objectives. And you look around Canada, do you think maybe that's what's happening? What does the Indian government care what happens in Canada so long as the benefits flow back to India? And we have a number and a lot of problems on that file. But as Carney signals that he's moving away from the United States, we're still funding 14 F-35s while publicly debating canceling the order. We're still paying for it. We're going to end up with these F-35s. There's another 16 in the pipes, and the procurement process continues, and the allocated monies keep channeling towards those F-35s. Now, maybe we're going to go to Europe and we're going to buy some other fighters, but we're going to end up with these F-35s. But the media is not covering that angle. Like, just so you know, Simple Flying, what the hell is this website? Canada's fighter jet debate has increasingly been framed as a dramatic political decision. Should Ottawa proceed with its planned purchase of F-35 stealth fighters or pivot towards alternatives such as Saab's Gripen? Public discussions have focused on cost overruns, industrial benefits, trade tensions with Washington, and broader questions surrounding Canada's long-term defense dependence on the United States, which isn't about to change. Doesn't matter if we order subs that will be delivered 10 or 15 years from now. And in the meantime, we got to try and patch our diesel electrics back together, which I don't even think any of them are in service. I think we had one that was in service, and I think it grounded. And it's out of service for like 10 years. What kind of submarine takes 10 years to repair? Now, I'll admit that I'm going from my memory on this. But the Canadian military is in quite a state of disrepair. We are at a very low level of readiness. Decades ago, we were running around the woods yelling bang because we couldn't afford to buy blank ammunition for our soldiers. That hasn't changed. We haven't bought the basics. The barracks are still full of forever chemicals that are killing our soldiers. We're not doing anything about it. We can't wave a magic wand and make Canada a military power. We require the United States. And we shouldn't be ungrateful for a nation that has to scramble its planes to intercept a simple little Cessna that flies away from Vancouver Airport. We couldn't get our guys, our planes, which, by the way, we can only field, it's something like 40% of our fighter jets, and we couldn't get them from Cold Lake, Alberta to Vancouver. I covered this in a previous edition a long time ago. We had to have the Americans do it. And we show great ingratitude for that. And we shouldn't. And I would argue behind closed doors, Carney probably isn't showing ingratitude. He's kissing Trump's backside, and we'll get to that. But we're still funding the F-35s. And it's interesting that Global News and CBC and all of the mainstream media, they're not really covering that angle. They're just covering the politics. They're just covering sort of the elbows up angle, and they're not really digging into what's happening underneath the surface. And then there's the Gordie Howe Bridge. Prime Minister Carney insists Gordie Howe Bridge tolls will not be shared until all debt is repaid. Well, that contradicts reports earlier in the week, which said that net revenue sharing, well, actually, it contradicts Carney himself. Here's the quote. Splitting of tolls, any sharing of toll revenue won't happen until all of the debt is repaid. Not really reasonable, but reasonable. Okay, we'll just say it's reasonable for now. Next sentence. We will split net revenues over the course of the first 15 years, and those net revenues are after operational costs. So which is it? Are we going to split net revenues before the debt is paid, or are we going to split it for the next 15 years? This guy's amazing. He's a magician because he can say two juxtaposed things, one after the other. The media is not curious about it, and his followers accept it. He literally contradicts himself from one sentence to the next. Which is it? Now, Canada has paid something like $6.2 billion for this bridge out of our pockets at interest. We don't have the money. We're running deficits. Interest rates have been going up. Not lately, but they've been going up over the course of time. I mean, it's an interesting thing that we measure such lasting economic decisions in such short spans of time, which is a whole other subject. Because when you require a long view of years to manage an economy, but you're measuring successes from one Bank of Canada meeting to the next, it's just weird. It's like short-term thinking and short-term application of long-term principles. Of course, nothing adds up because nothing adds up anymore. But which is it? We're paying interest. So the revenue is going to come in. And if we believe the second sentence, which is we split net revenues, that means we deduct cost, we deduct payments, we deduct the interest on those payments, and we deduct snow removal and maintenance costs. And then we split that, and 50% goes to the Americans, for what I don't know, and 50% comes to us. Or if it goes the other way, we will take all the revenue and we'll pay the debt off. But I don't think that's how this is going to go. I think the second sentence is true. So this is, once again, Carney saying one thing and showing what I think is a pro-American agenda through actions. NATO defense spending spend burden to shift. Carney says, as Trump pressures allies. So this was the recent NATO meeting. And Carney, as far as I'm concerned, had nothing but nice things to say about Trump. And it's interesting that Global News frames it. Carney told reporters in Turkey on the last day of the summit that Trump is looking to shift that burden, something former U.S. President Barack Obama had sought as well. Why do we have to bring Barack into it? We all know the answer. Because Barack's the good guy. Obama's the good guy. So if Obama wanted it, we can't fault Trump for wanting it. We're not paying Trump a compliment. We're paying Obama a compliment. Like, our media sucks in this country so much because they do things like this that are completely unnecessary for making the point and telling the story. This isn't supposed to be commentary. This is supposed to be journalism. I'm a commentator. These are journalists. I say I do a better job at journalism, even though I'm a commentator, than the journalists do. At any rate, it's good because Obama wanted it. But Carney said he's been successful. He successfully lobbied NATO to increase their spending. He successfully lobbied NATO to take on more of the burden. And from day one to day two, Trump's story shifted too. He went from being viscerally angry at everybody to being conciliatory on the second day. And that's because I think they're all cooperating. I think it's all optics. I think it's for public consumption. I think it's for their bases. And to that point, all I see is evidence that suggests that while Mark Carney is signaling to Canadians that he's going to defend us and defend our interests and defend our sovereignty, he's actually working to make sure we're in a position to be more successfully integrated with the United States. And again, that just serves his interest. That serves his bottom line. That serves Brookfield. That serves his assets. That serves his family and his money. It's pretty wild to see that everything is proceeding pretty much as I thought it was going to proceed. And there's nothing that I can say or do about it. Once again, you look around online, you look at the state of commentary, and it's all nonsense. It's all clickbait. You know, one of the reasons I'm skeptical of the independence movement in the West, I wasn't sure I was going to talk about this, but it's because some of the most vocal proponents, some of the most popular voices on X and on the platforms are anonymous accounts. Anonymous accounts who just say stupid, uncontrolled things all the time. This isn't everybody. The people who act in their name do a better job. But these are accounts that get 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 likes. They'll get a couple thousand retweets, and they'll say, Carney, you can F off. And people are like, yeah! But it doesn't sell it. It doesn't make a logical case. It doesn't help advance the cause. And all the polling from all the different polling houses suggests that less than a third of Albertans actually support the concept of independence. And I actually think this is why. I think there's too much of a spotlight on really terrible people promoting the idea. And it's tragic because it's a really good idea. Western Canada is not served by this federation. Western Canada is not served by Eastern Canada. As I said in a recent tweet, it's okay to get a divorce. Still be friends afterwards. Still do business afterwards. But there's very little that holds this country together. I've lived in both halves of it. Where I live in the West is very different mentally. It's a very different culture. Very different business model. Very different way of thinking from Eastern Canada. And there's no shame in wanting to create a different arrangement. But I don't see an abundance of really good leadership when it comes to promoting this idea. In fact, I see a lot of toxic leadership. It could be these accounts are run right out of Liberal Party headquarters. Or maybe they're run out of the Conservative Party headquarters. Because ever since Pierre Poilievre lost his seat in Carleton and parachuted himself into the safest conservative riding in the country, right in the middle of Alberta, he's just been conveying the message that it's a bad relationship, it's a terrible relationship, But it's better than no relationship at all. And we have to stay. And this is, it always comes down to this. The West gives the Conservative Party all of its support, all of its treasure, its donations. It funds that war chest that they're always bragging about having. It gives the Conservative Party its talking points. It tries to bestow on the Conservative Party its values. And then they take all that and they go east and they become liberals. And they fill the party with a soft underbelly that Carney has very successfully, to his credit, poached time and time again, undermining the entire conservative movement. And the whole time, I'm told by so many people I shouldn't be picking on poor Pierre. It's not his fault. He will make a great prime minister. I'm just not sure when. How is it, after how long he's been leader now, when am I supposed to hold him accountable for the same things that we all, during the Conservative Party leadership rate, you know, we were willing to hold Aaron O'Toole accountable. We were willing to hold Andrew Scheer accountable after the fact. How long do we get into this process of the entire conservative movement in this country being undermined from within and from without before you hold leadership accountable for it? Somebody actually said to me the other day in one of the brief quips, because like the only thing I'm able to do is in the evenings post on Twitter a bit or through the day when I get a second, but somebody said, stop picking on Pierre. And it's like, is that where we're at? People white knighting and begging. Don't talk about Pierre. Like, it's so pathetic. I just believe that an opposition should be strong. It should be courageous. It should be calling out very aggressively Carney's pro-American stances. It should be calling out elbows up for the fakery that it actually is. It should be very unapologetic. It should be painting, I would dare say, a socially conservative contrast. Instead of safe injection sites and the transification of everything, it should be taking the other side of that bet. Sobriety, self-control, maybe some stigma around hard drug use, maybe a pro-family stance, maybe saying, you know what? A man and a woman together having three children is probably the best economic unit the human race has ever devised. There's no champion for the family, man. Everybody's afraid to talk about the threads that are holding the entire project of Western civilization together. Instead, it's just a group of, whether it's mass immigration advocates, whether it's rainbow advocates, everybody seems to be running and gunning at those threads with nice sharp scissors, trying to sever them. Now, what is that? What is that self-destructive urge to just destroy everything that was good? Now, I got to go back to my life. And I'll have to do that for a little while longer. And that's why, you know, I appreciate everybody. I appreciate the audience. I appreciate the emails. I am still trying to make an effort to keep up with emails and messages privately, even though I'm not doing much in public. I just really appreciate the community. I always will. Got distracted there by my own. Objectively speaking, things were better in the past. Not the ancient past. If you want to go back, I mean, every time I bring up the past being better, people are like, oh, you want people to die at 26 in the 1850s, you idiot? Like, we don't have to go that far back. We can just go back to the 1960s and the 1970s and the 1950s or the 1980s or the 1990s. Everything was objectively better. One man could support his family. A woman could stay home and raise her children, which, whether you think women should be forced to do that, I don't. But the vast majority of women left on their own, that's what they want to do. They want to nurture. And why is that such a shameful activity? This is that self-destructive thing I'm talking about. In the dynamic in my household, my wife is the one that's responsible in many ways for passing on civilization to the next generation. The literacy that I opened my video talking about is largely driven by her efforts. What could be more precious than preserving the human race? Like, why is motherhood a shameful thing? Men shouldn't be shaming stay-at-home wives any more than society should be shaming stay-at-home wives, because it's a full-time job. Spend some time with your children and actually do it properly. Don't just hand them a tablet for 12 hours a day. Actually spend the time and you'll learn it's work. It's wonderful work. It's great work. It's fun work. But it's time and it's effort. And I don't know why it's been denigrated. It's been denigrated by feminists. It's been denigrated at times by men. It's been denigrated by society. And there's just no, there's nothing more important. And I don't know what that is. I don't know why we instinctively have to hate everything good and beautiful, why we have to destroy it, why we have to attack it, why we have to take scissors to the threads that bind our society together, to the things that built it. What was wrong with lower taxes and one income carrying a home? It was objectively better. All you have to do, and I'll finish with this, and it's a tragedy. You go on a subway, you go on public transit, you take a walk down the street in your average city, whether it's in the United States, because it's true of there. This isn't just a Canadian thing. This is a rot that's particularly acute in North America. It's like people have given up. They don't even put on clothes anymore. They don't shower. They're wearing their pajamas and flip-flops out in stores. Everybody looks, not everybody, but a lot of people, they're just slobs. It's like they've given up. Crime is rampant, drug abuse is everywhere, and people just shrug their shoulders and look down and keep walking. People are getting killed every single day because of our lax immigration laws, and people just shrug their shoulders and go back to whatever digital distraction is their opiate of choice. It wasn't supposed to be this way, and it wasn't always this way. It was objectively better in the past when these things didn't exist. Now, you can argue about the cause. I think one of the principal causes is the robbery of inflation, that the men in suits, the people who run the central banks, just print money and rob you of your purchasing power. I think people, even people who don't understand economics, at some instinctual, fundamental level, understand that they're being ripped off. That when they're being gaslit by the president or anybody else, that their 401ks are through the roof and the stock market is up. That in actual purchasing power, the stock market has been robbing people. Hasn't been keeping up. It's been losing versus real assets, versus farmland, productive businesses, gold, silver, versus real assets. And inevitably, there'll be somebody in the comments that'll say, well, real estate prices are down, gold is down, silver is down. What do you say about that? Too short-term a view. Long-term, money and interest, fiat currency, has been a failure, and I think people instinctively know that the proposition of time for wage is becoming far less attractive. And so they're checking out. They're not just checking out from the workforce. They're checking out from life. They're not even taking care of themselves anymore. We used to live in a society where everybody wore a suit. Everybody put themselves together every day. The women were beautiful. Everybody was trim and slim. You know, you look at that old archive footage of the past. Nobody was fat. The food system wasn't corrupted. The money was sound. You could afford things. You could live a decent quality of life. Can anybody really argue that that's disappeared? That whether you're a capitalist or a socialist, doesn't matter what side of the spectrum you come from, that all of that has faded away and that the dream is dying? And while all of that is true, society seems content to attack the threads that are left holding the tapestry together that used to be so great. At any rate, I'm one of those threads. And I'm going to go keep being that thread with my family at this time. I'll see you in the next one.